Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the African American Research Library and Cultural Center in Fort Lauderdale has a new exhibit focusing on the Harlem Renaissance.
What we have in our Dorothy Porter Wesley collection is some 3,400 items that include rare books, pamphlets, postcards.
We'll discuss the history of Barnett Bank in Florida.
William B. Barnett arrived in Jacksonville only a few weeks before he established the Bank of Jacksonville, a town that already hosted three of the five banks to be found in the entire state.
And we'll talk with Orange County Regional History Center historian Rachel Williams. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Jazz composer Duke Ellington was part of the Harlem Renaissance, a blossoming of African-American culture in the 1920s and 30s. The movement included Florida artists like writer Zora Neale Hurston, sculptor Augusta Savage, and poet James Weldon Johnson. A new exhibit celebrating the Harlem Renaissance is on display at the African-American Research Library and Cultural Center in Fort Lauderdale, where Tamika Bradley Hobbs is regional manager.
The African American Research Library and Cultural Center really stands as a pretty unique institution. At the time that it was opened in 2002, it was only the third such institution of its kind in the nation. That was modeled after the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, as attached to the New York Public Library, as well as the Auburn Avenue Research Library in Atlanta. I think there have been at least two other publicly funded but intentionally African-American-focused institutions established since that time, but that still makes ARLIC quite significant. We are one of two flagship institutions for Broward County Public Library Division that has 37 libraries altogether, but we are special in that we have both a cultural center on our first floor, a circulating library, and of course, an archives and special collections.
The African American Research Library and Cultural Center will be showing the exhibit Feel the Beauty, the Literature and Art of the Harlem Renaissance through June 28th. It features thousands of items, including rare books, pamphlets, and postcards.
Really, really excited about it. Of course, we're in a season of centennial anniversaries for the Harlem Renaissance, which was just an incredible movement of visual arts, literature, performing arts at a time where African Americans were really struggling against negative caricatures, negative stereotypes, Jim Crow, and a part of that, of course, was the Great Migration. When you think about what fueled all of this, it is the massive movement of African Americans out of the South. I really consider them to be refugees, if you will, moving to the North with the hopes of living lives of greater promise, greater opportunity. And it's because of those concentrations of Black people in places like New York City, in the neighborhoods like Harlem, that we have all of this taking place. And so this year, 2025, represents the centennial of a publication of a really core work for that movement. I'm referring to The New Negro, which was edited by Elaine Locke, who was considered to be the dean of the Harlem Renaissance and the efforts that he made to encourage, to recruit, to mentor, and to publish and give platform to young writers and young artists during this period in time. And so to tell this story, as you mentioned, we are calling upon a collection that we happen to house in our archives, and that is the personal library of Dorothy Porter Wesley. Not many people know her name, but we should. She was one of the most important Black librarians of the 20th century. She was a bibliophile, a collector. As a part of her resume, she is credited with beginning the Moreland Springer Research Library at Howard University, which is one of the premier collections on Black life, history, and culture. But it was her that organized that. She spent a career of about over 40 years at that institution and did some really quite remarkable things because of her intention of coalescing and organizing material on Black life. That, of course, is really important. But the other thing that I recently have learned about her is what a renegade she was in the field of librarianship. She had to contend with the Dewey Decimal System, which, like so many elements in our culture, bore the hallmarks of segregation and racism. She found that the specifications or the space that was given to categorize Black life was incredibly narrow and lacked imagination of the breadth and depth of Black life and Black creativity. And so Dorothy Porter took it upon herself to expand this system. She doctored it. She made it what she needed to be in order to catalog this collection, which ended up being 180,000 items up at Howard University Library. And she began to share this system that she had developed on top of the Dewey Decimal System with other Black librarians, folks at the Schomburg and other places. But when the people who had oversight for the Dewey Decimal System found out, they were not too happy, threatened her with taking her credentials, demanded that she not share and that other people not use the system that she collected. But of course, they did it anyway. And for that reason, some people refer to Dorothy Porter Wesley as the midwife of the Black Studies movement. If it had not been for her efforts and the efforts of other librarians like her, we would not have had the raw material to begin to tell the story of Black life in earnest.
It was in 1930 that Howard University had Dorothy Porter Wesley assemble a collection of resource materials by and about African Americans. The books and other materials on display at the African American Research Library and Cultural Center in Fort Lauderdale are from Dorothy Porter Wesley's private collection. Tamika Bradley Hobbs.
The material that we have, the rare book collection that was gifted to us by Constance Porter Gulczak, her daughter, was her personal library. So as you can imagine, you know, she's collecting for a specific purpose for her job, but she's also, as the case may be, pulling things for her own collection that she thinks is valuable. And so what we have in our Dorothy Porter Wesley collection is some 3,400 items that include rare books, pamphlets, postcards. And what we pulled down for the exhibition are primarily some of those publications. We have a signed copy of Carter G. Woodson's The Negro in History. We have a first edition of God's Trombones by James Weldon Johnson that comes from Dorothy Porter Wesley's collection. But something that we've done that is a bit unique, and I want to give credit to our curators, Chris Norwood and Dr. Sean Christian. They combed through Ms. Wesley's collection and brought forward several editions of the Negro History Bulletin. That was something that was started, a publication that was started specifically with a focus on educating children about Black history. And it was serialized. And so what visitors will find in our exhibition is a prominent feature, not only on Dr. Carter G. Woodson explaining why he was doing what he was doing, but they'll be able to view several editions of the Negro History Bulletin. And that's really important in this day and time where We are kind of back to square one in some ways when it comes to Black history education. I know here at ARLIC, in response to some of what we've seen, we've started offering free Black history courses to families one Saturday a month. And I was really inspired by the work and legacy of Dr. Woodson, that what we need to know and what we need to teach our children about Black history is much too important to be left to chance or to left to misinterpretation. And so I really think there's an important lesson and inspiration that can come from coming to this exhibition and knowing and learning a little bit more about Dr. Woodson and his work.
Tamika Bradley Hobbs is regional manager of the African American Research Library and Cultural Center in Fort Lauderdale, where the exhibition Feel the Beauty, the Literature and Art of the Harlem Renaissance is on display through June 28th. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to watch more than 60 archived episodes of our public television series, Florida Frontiers, and be sure to look for it on your local PBS station as well. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, there was a time not long ago when banks demonstrated their reliability and security with sturdy buildings that displayed lots of marble and solemn-faced employees. Today's banks use advertising to promote visions of happy customers engaging with friendly bank employees inside buildings that are light and airy. However, most people conduct their banking online and never or seldom interact with a bank employee.
Banking has changed enormously in less than half a century. David J. Genzel, at the time of publication, an independent scholar from Jacksonville, takes us back to the early days of banking in Florida in his article on the Barnett family, published in the summer 2000 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly. First established as the Bank of Jacksonville in 1877, the Barnett Banks Incorporated finally came to an end in 1998 when Nations Bank acquired its assets. For 120 years, five generations of Barnetts built and sustained a financial institution that, by the time of its demise, operated more than 600 offices across Florida, with assets totaling $44 billion. Opening with a capital investment of $43,000, William B. Barnett and his sons became banking leaders in the early years of the state's economic growth. Hal Barnett acquired the capital to found what quickly became the deposit bank for state funds and an important, if often little noticed, actor in state and national development projects is a story worth hearing. Genzel's narration of the banking house illustrates both the opportunities available to men like William Barnett and the importance of character in the volatile world of banking and finance in turn-of-the-century Florida. William B. Barnett arrived in Jacksonville only a few weeks before he established the Bank of Jacksonville, a town that already hosted three of the five banks to be found in the entire state. Banking was a risky business, and it seems improbable that men would trust their money to someone they did not know. Barnett's oldest son, Will, operated a furniture store in the town, but he had only lived in Jacksonville a few years, not enough time to establish a reputation of trustworthiness, one would think. And yet, people seemingly trusted William Barnett his whole life. Born in 1824 to a modestly prosperous family, William left school to apprentice himself to a saddle and harness maker after his father lost everything in a deal gone bad. In 1858, Barnett moved his wife Sarah and their two children to Hiawatha, Kansas, a village of, quote, a half dozen frame houses and a country store. Barnett bought the store and a number of parcels of land. He did not fight for either side in the Civil War, but did become involved in local politics and supported the construction of a rail line through the town. In 1870, he formed Barnett, Merrill & Company, a private bank. His move to Florida came shortly after a visit with his son Will, who lived in Jacksonville. The decision to relocate may have been an effort to improve the health of Sarah. The sale of the store, land, and bank in Hiawatha provided the capital for establishing the Bank of Jacksonville.
Connie, Barnett sounds like an astute businessman, always at the right place at the right time, with enough capital to invest in the next moneymaker.
He was, but Barnett was a man of principles. His portrait, which is included in the article, shows a stern man who you would expect to be honest and upright in his dealings. According to Genzel, he gave his son Byron 5 business rules to follow, which the son remembered more than 50 years later. Barnett's rules included an admonition to live by the golden rule, a warning against doing business at a loss, encouragement to support young men of promise, regardless of their initial station in life, a caution against making promises you cannot keep, and finally an assurance that, quote, if you watch your expense account and your losses, your profits will take care of themselves, end quote. Barnett opened his bank as a private bank, which meant the institution did not fall under state incorporation or federal banking laws. In essence, it was a private company for providing capital for projects favored by the owners and shareholders. The bank attracted depositors and made its first loan on its first day. The Bank of Jacksonville was robbed during its first year of operation. One of the robbers was caught, but the $7,500 they stole was never recovered. Nevertheless, by 1880, the fortunes of the Barnetts and the bank became intimately tied to local and state politics.
Connie, how did a Yankee from the much-reviled state of Kansas manage to become a major player in Florida's turn-of-the-century economic development?
A marriage, an election, and Hamilton Diston all played roles in the elevation of the Jacksonville Bank to state and national prominence. The Barnetts kept a low profile regarding their Yankee status, but became a part of the city's elite when in 1880, Byron married Caroline Hallows Lingle, a descendant of Francis Philip Fascio. Lina Barnett brought her husband and his family into the elite social and civic circles of Jacksonville. One of Lina's cousins, Henry Lingle, was the tax collector for Duval County. The Bank of Jacksonville offered the county a better deal on their deposits that would save money, and Lingle transferred the county's tax accounts to the Barnett Bank. The following year, newly elected Governor William Bloxam appointed Henry Lingle state treasurer, and the state accounts were moved to the Bank of Jacksonville. As Genzel explains, quote, the bank's new role as state depository coincided with the Diston land purchase, a watershed event in Florida's history that ushered in a period of prosperity, end quote. Diston purchased 4 million acres of land from the Florida Internal Improvement Fund for 25 cents per acre. He sold half the land to English shipbuilder Sir Edward Reed. The Bank of Jacksonville loaned the money Reed needed to complete the deal. As Byron Barnett recalled, quote, Reed was slow in paying us, and it was only after we had notified him we were going to enforce our lien on the collateral that he raised the money in New York, end quote. Although Diston's scheme led to his financial ruin, the land purchase initiated a development boom that included the construction of railroads that linked the citrus producers to markets, spurred winter tourism, and encouraged urban development. In 1888, the Bank of Jacksonville received a national charter and became the National Bank of Jacksonville. 2 years later, the bank moved into a new stone building at the corner of Bay and Laura Streets. The bank weathered multiple crises, that destroyed less well-managed financial institutions, the yellow fever epidemic of 1888, the phosphate speculation boom of the 1890s that destroyed two national banks and crippled a third in Jacksonville alone, the national panic of 1893, the citrus freeze of 1894-95, and the Jacksonville fire of 1901. The National Bank of Jacksonville survived the fire intact and offered space in their vault for other banks to store their safes until they could rebuild. As Genzel concludes, the conservative fiscal policies practiced by the Barnetts and their reputation local and statewide for honesty and integrity sustained their banking house for over 120 years and benefited both the city of Jacksonville and the state of Florida.
I believe I had an account at Barnett Bank in Orlando in the 1990s. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. The Florida Historical Society will be visiting the Orange County Regional History Center in May during the FHS Public History Forum. Sebastian Garcia spoke with their historian, Rachel Williams.
The Orange County Regional History Center remains one of the most significant historical institutions in Central Florida through its permanent and temporary museum exhibits, research archives, community events, and educational programming. Their mission is, quote, to serve as the gateway for community engagement, education, and inspiration by preserving and sharing Central Florida's continually unfolding story, end quote. As the Orange County Regional History Center's historian, Rachel Williams maintains the organization's mission by primarily conducting and archiving oral histories with individuals connected to or from the Central Florida area.
I research events and people that have lived here and try to find their contact information, which is kind of sleuthy sometimes. So I will record their life story, basically. All of the oral histories that we have are biographical oral histories. So it records from their family history up until what they're currently doing in the present day. So it really gets a huge span of their life and the impact that they've made in society in Central Florida. And with some of that also comes donations to the collection as well as physical objects. So we can really get a lot of neat material in terms of the story behind the objects and how they came to be. So it's really awesome to see different parts of the community, the various communities that are in Central Florida. So for example, tomorrow I have an oral history with someone that was the director of communications. At one point, he worked a number of roles. He started off as a writer and then became the director of communications for Tupperware, which up until literally the last year has been headquartered in Orlando since the 50s. So I've already done a lot of research on Tupperware, but I might do a little bit more research into him and see kind of, you know, what else has he done within Tupperware that I can find. And then also just thinking about questions in terms of, okay, I know that, you know, this happened within Tupperware history that was a big deal. Let me see what his role, or if he had a role in this particular event, or, you know, just things like that. I try to keep in mind those big events and time periods that they might have lived through regarding his work, or even just in life in general. Was he also a veteran? Was his father a veteran? How did that impact his life? Because again, we want to kind of get like a big picture of this person's life and the impact and role that they've played, not only in their work, but in, you know, the community and society as well. And after I do the interview, I catalog it, and then that will have an audio log associated with it. And that is essentially just a timestamp for certain subjects that are being discussed so that researchers who are interested in the topic of the interview can go and find the information they need. So instead of listening to an hour and a half long recording when they just need like 3 minutes of information, they can easily find that information.
Additionally, Rachel oversees the editorial process for the Orange County Regional History Center's magazine titled Reflections.
My role in that so far has just kind of been like project management in terms of, okay, we need to find this many people to write articles. This is the general theme for this issue. Who can write an article relating to this theme? I think one of the challenges has been finding diverse stories and the people that can tell them. Also, I have a decent knowledge of our photograph collection And I have to find photos to go with the articles. And I send those over to our graphic designer, and he kind of makes the layout and make it look really nice in the final product of the magazine. But it's a lot of sifting through photos, some of which are not cataloged. So I'm just digging through the stacks.
Creating programs that allow visitors and community members to engage with history in a more accessible way remains a central component of Rachel's job as the Orange County Regional History Center's historian and, by extension, the institution's broader mission.
That's the big thing, is making history accessible. People wonder, like, why are things this way? Well, we can always look to history and find out the reason for why things are this way, whether it's, you know, something that's a little bit more existential or something that is more like a fun, quirky, fun fact. I think that we can find answers in all of that. So I think that making history accessible to everyone and making it engaging and interesting is very important. That's a big part of my job. And I'm trying to find ways to do that in a lot of different facets to reach as many people as possible. We're open from 10 to 5, so we close by the time that other people get out of work. So I started thinking about that and how do we reach this kind of middle-aged demographic? So we have something that's been going on for a long time called Third Thursdays, which are the third Thursday of every month, and it is free. It's extended hours. It's open till 9 and it's free admission. And there's other stuff going on downtown in the area as well. But I wanted to kind of beef that up a little bit instead of just having free admission. Let's have fun activities. Let's have retro games. Let's have butter making, which has been really popular. People have been really excited about making butter. You know, let's have let's have beer and wine. You know, we're already downtown. Let's have a little, you know, museum after dark experience kind of a thing. So now we're going to start doing that plus themes behind it a little bit as well. So we're going to do like a murder mystery and an activity that we found in like yearbooks where people would write little love notes in old yearbooks and just like interesting things that we find that we can create a theme to. So I've just been kind of thinking a little bit more creatively about how to incorporate history, bring more of the community in, and just create fun, engaging activities for people of all ages, but especially that group that I felt like we were missing in our visitors.
To learn more about the Orange County Regional History Center, visit them at 65 East Central Boulevard in downtown Orlando or anytime online at thehistorycenter.org. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org and find us on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.